alcoholic. And I'd like to start just with a moment of silence. Okay, don't want too long of silence because I know it's being recorded. Before we start, I got some of these Big Book Awakenings that some of you heard about. It's a guidebook that I use when I work with people. If anybody hasn't got one, feel free to grab one. If you want to take a look at what I do. I think one of the things that I like to do, it's one thing to come and talk about all this stuff, and it's another thing to do it. So to have the instructions and the information that I give other people, I think is real helpful for me to leave with people, because it gives you the opportunity to see the instructions and do what I'm talking about. I'm not actually going to be going through that myself today, page by page, but I'm just going to go through the big book, talk about some stuff and my experience with that. And where we left off yesterday is I talked about my home group and my sponsor and, that I picked up in my home group. But it was after going through four or five other people in the program. And I think I mentioned it last night that it was interesting that it was hard to find someone in Alcoholics Anonymous that really knew anything about the 12 steps. For some people, the 12-step program means go to meetings. And in some meetings, and some people, they want to like brag that they use the big book as a coaster, right? Which a lot of people find very amusing. Okay. And the only reason you would find it amusing is if you kind of agreed with that. But I think anybody that has had a deep experience with the big book would find a little problem with finding that amusing, right? And I see that a lot of people have latched on to the 12 and 12 as the guide to go through the steps. Probably, in my opinion, it's just a lot easier to find step one. It's a lot easier to find step two. You know, it's broken down in sections. But you know, people in Alcoholics Anonymous stayed sober for 15 years without a 12 and 12. Right? So obviously they were doing something else prior to that. And when I look at step one, I look at what I was told to do was start step one from the doctor's opinion. And it was interesting, in the information in the front of the book, it breaks down, Bill breaks down some important facts about the doctor's opinion. And if you have your book, you can turn to see where I'm going to start from. Just XVI. The top of the page, he talks a little bit about being exposed. Bill talks a little bit about being exposed to the Oxford group. But he also mentions that he's greatly helped by Dr. Silkworth, the New York specialist on alcoholism, who was accounted no less than a medical saint by AA members. So I'd say that he's giving Dr. Silkworth quite a bit of credit here for Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay. And it says, from the doctor, the broker had learned the grave nature of alcoholism. Though he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford group, he he was convinced of, and it lists five tenets that he was convinced of the Oxford group. But there's one tenet, there were six tenets, and there was one tenet that he didn't list here, and that was complete deflation of ego. And that's what step one has to do for me. Complete deflation of the idea, of any idea that I have that I'm going to be able to stay sober on my own. Again, I had mentioned it last night. When I first got here, there was people that told me that if I'm here, I did the first step. But the idea that I needed a God to save me from this, a power bigger than myself, greater than myself, I didn't grasp that just walking in. Which means that step one has to result in an experience that, not that I can't drink again, but there's nothing stopping me from drinking again. That's ultimately the experience that I need from step one. And then it goes on to say that last paragraph, the physician had, where it talks about Dr. Bob, it says the physician had repeatedly tried spiritual means to resolve his alcoholic dilemma, but had failed. But when the broker gave him Dr. Silkworth's description of alcoholism and its hopelessness, the physician began to pursue the spiritual remedy for his malady with a willingness he had never before been able to muster. So when he understood what was wrong with him, something changed. See, Dr. Bob had a spiritual program. He was going to church. He was familiar with the Oxford group. But he wasn't staying sober. And when Bill brought him the doctor's opinion on what's wrong with him, something changed. Because he realized that there was something more going on than what he had previously thought. And I can really relate to that in the sense that I knew I was out of control, but I never knew that I couldn't. That it never was clear that I would never, on my own, be out of control. I knew I couldn't control how much I drank. That became obvious. But I never grasped the idea that I would never be able to change that on my own. There's a part of my drinking that I just didn't understand. I didn't know certain facts about my drinking. I did know that I lost control, but I didn't know that I couldn't start without losing control. Right? So there's something in the doctor's opinion that I had to see. And when I look at the doctor's opinion, that's where I start step one. The other thing that I want to mention is in the first edition, the doctor's opinion was page one. So Bill thought it was important enough to know what the doctor was saying about this to put it in the beginning of the book. So at some point, it got rolled back into the Roman numerals. And I don't know if you were like me, but you know, I wasn't a great reader when I first came in here. I'd read a paragraph and not know what I just read. So I would skip past anything that I thought wasn't necessarily that important. So I'd usually start books from page one, missing the doctor's opinion altogether. You know, and Bill stressed how important that part was right in the front of the book. Right? There was something in the doctor's opinion that I needed to understand in order to realize the grave nature of my problem. Right? And the doctor talks about this as being like an allergy. Now, an allergy meant something different back then to people. Back in the 30s, you couldn't go into a grocery store and have a whole aisle full of allergy remedies. There was no allergy doctors. There was no medications for it yet. Nothing that was easy. If a child had, or if you had an allergy to bee stings and you got stung by a bee, they'd have to rush you to the hospital, poke a hole in your throat so you could breathe until the swelling went down, right? Same thing with allergies to stuff in the yard or in the area, that's plants and pollen or whatever. So an allergy was a life-threatening problem that affected me in a way that it didn't affect other people, and there was no cure for it. So from that perspective, I can relate to alcohol being a life-threatening problem for me. It didn't affect other people like it affected me, and nobody knew how to help me with it. So from that perspective, it was just like an allergy. And I didn't quite understand that either yet, until it was described to me as simply as is looking at my experience, not what I was thinking, but my experience. Did I lose control when I started physically? And at first, I wanted to go into my mind and try to figure out, you know, how the loss of control felt. But face it, after a few drinks, you're not feeling much anyway. Right? And what I realized is what I had to do is look at how the loss of control looked rather than how it felt. And looking back at my experiences, that I could see that I usually got more drunk than I should have. Not all the time, but most of the time. Now, what's too drunk? You know? Right? It's an opinion, right? What's too drunk? For my grandmother, she would take a couple sips of something like, people always brought her things like Bailey's and the sweet drinks. She'd take a couple sips of something, and she'd say, oh, I'm starting to feel it, I have to stop. Yeah. You know, that's when it starts for me, when I'm starting to feel it. Right? So what's too drunk? Yeah, so I can't look at just getting drunk as my indicator as what was too much. But when I saw in my experience that I would drink enough that I couldn't even make it home to my wife. Right? I would drink so much when I would take clients out that they would leave me at the bar. Right? And not be necessarily too excited about going back to a bar with me again at other times. Right? I would drink too much to be able to hold up my business, to make it to work in the morning. You know, there was times that I had to call employees to come pick me up because I was too out of it in the morning, even just to drive to work. Right? So when I even look at how much I drank, it was hard for me to see my lack of control. But when I saw how it impacted my life, where I saw the physical craving, the lack of control once I started, and how it impacted my life. And the thing about the physical craving, that's actually something that even the people around me could see. Right? But I've always never been short of people that thought I had all this potential in my life. A lot of people trusted that I was intelligent. I had a business, and I seemed to be able to hold stuff together on the outside for a while. But there was the people that were closest to me, like my wife, there was still a little bit of confusion. It's like, when did our life turn into what it turned into? I mentioned a little bit about my ex-wife. She was so nice when I met her. I don't know, you know, they used to say, I don't know what happened to her. She just turned into some kind of monster. And I never really thought that she was reacting to the way I was living. And I drove her crazy, and she didn't know why even. She didn't know why her life had become so stagnant and why she had to spend so much time alone. So other people can actually see the physical craving in us. Right? But they, I don't think, understood it any more than I did. So the book is laid out pretty simple for me. I start looking at the physical craving from the doctor's opinion up until page bottom of 22 to the top of 23. And it's interesting because at the end of each section, it'll end with a summary of what I'm supposed to get out of the section that it just covered. And it says, we are positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. Right? So you'll see at the end of each section, there'll be a summary. I'm supposed to be clear that, without a doubt, that regularly, practically every time, my experience abundantly confirms that once I start drinking, I don't know when it's going to end. Whether it's going to be 3 drinks or 10 drinks, whether it's going to be 3 hours or 3 days. Something happens, you know, and I can't do anything about that. I can't stop that on my own. It goes on to say that these observations would be academic or pointless if the friend never took the first drink. So, in other words, it's good to know that I lose control when I start, but it would mean nothing if I just don't take the first drink. And you hear people tell you in meetings, just don't drink no matter what. Right? But here it's saying I drink no matter what, because I couldn't just not drink. And I didn't understand that on my own. I didn't understand why that happened. But this started to put words to my experience. Right? Didn't necessarily tell me anything new, but it put words to what was happening. Because here it's saying that there's a mental side of this problem. Something going on in my mind. And it's not just a thought about alcohol, but an obsession. And an obsession is an idea that outweighs all other ideas. And I know that when I was new, I was really concerned because you hear a lot of people say, I'm thinking about drinking. Right? That's not necessarily a problem. Because if you're really an alcoholic, and alcohol did for you what it did for me, you know, thinking about drinking would be kind of normal, right? Wouldn't be abnormal, you know, because alcohol did something for me that nothing else did. Right? But there is a particular insanity that I had about it. Because even when I was thinking about not drinking, I would drink anyway. Right? And that's, in there lies the deeper problem, is when I was thinking about not drinking and drinking anyway. I talked a little bit about this yesterday, about the not being powerlessness until I tried to do something and fail. As long as I wanted to get drunk, right, I was setting out to do something, and I did what I wanted to do, lived the way I wanted to live, drank the way I wanted to drink. But there came the day when I started to tell myself how I needed to cut back or stop or limit certain, you know, my drinking to certain times. And at first, it was just a shock to me. And as time went on, it was very confusing. Why is it that I got to the point where I threw the wife out, I trashed the business, found me walking to the liquor store, talking out loud to myself, telling myself, I don't want to do this anymore. Why couldn't I not go to the liquor store? Not everybody has that experience. Some people just have an intervention and get thrown into a rehab, and the theory of all that, gets handed to them. But I think an intervention would have robbed me from that experience of trying to stop on my own and failing. Plenty of people I know had that experience where they just came to hit a wall and just had to get to AA. But I went 2 years in that place. I don't know that I needed 2 years of it, but I didn't know what else to do. And from the top of page 23 up to 43, it's going to help me look at the idea that I have particular insanity when it comes to alcohol, right? And it's an insanity that I have to see and have to have an experience with that prior to getting into step two, right? Because when step two, seeing that I need a power greater than myself to restore me to sanity, the insanity they're talking about is not that I get in trouble at work or that I have problems at home necessarily by itself. They're talking about an insanity in my life that takes me to the drink. Because if I didn't have that insanity, then when I saw that I drank too much, I would just tell myself, I can't do that. And I've had friends that do that. They'll say, well, I can't drink because I get into trouble with it. And they just don't drink. And I said the same exact thing. I can't drink because I get into trouble with it. And I drank anyway. Over and over and over. So here's what it says at the end of 43, at the end of that mental section. It says, once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink, except in a few rare cases. Neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. So what it's saying here is that, and I can really relate to this, is my family couldn't stop that from happening to me. The therapist couldn't stop it. I couldn't stop it. Nobody could stop that obsession that took me to that first grade. So the idea that I can depend on anybody here in the room to stop that first drink is unrealistic. The group cannot keep me sober. Cannot keep me sober. And then in there lies a whole other argument and debate that some of you might have had with people. But we'll get into that later. So what I have to see here is that I have a mental condition that takes me to the first drink. Everybody knows that, right? You've heard that before, right? But then there's a bigger question. Okay, I have a physical craving, a problem when I start to drink. I see I have a mind that takes me to that first drink. So what is the condition conducive to setting up that insanity that takes me to the first drink? That would be important to know, wouldn't it? What is it what is the condition that I suffer from that's conducive for those obsessions to return? A lot of people don't talk about that. Now, it's interesting, as you get into the book, on 44, you'll see the first paragraph outlines what you're supposed to have got from the previous section. It talks about what you should have learned in the previous chapter. They hope that they've made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. And if you honestly want to and you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control of the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. But it says, if that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. When I got into the program, I wasn't short of hearing people that say this is a spiritual program or that this is a spiritual problem. Right? I heard both of those things. And I was very confused with the word spirituality because I associated that with religion. You know, and what does it actually mean to have, you know, a spiritual problem? When I was new, I thought, well, it just means I'm drinking, right? You know, which sort of cuts out a big section out of the middle because I needed something to hang on to. Just taking you telling me that this is a spiritual problem just on faith, that was fine for some people, but I didn't have that kind of makeup. I needed to understand what that means. And it goes on to talk to about some things that are really important for long-term sobriety. Talks about on the bottom of 44, it says, if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many would have recovered long ago, but we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us. No matter how much we tried, we could wish to be moral, we could wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, we could will these things with all our might, but the needed power wasn't there. I always thought I was a real moral guy. Simply meant I thought I knew what was right or wrong. Right? But my actions were that of someone who did what was right for himself, even at your expense. So I knew what was right or wrong, but I did what was right for me. I didn't have the ability to do what was right for you at my expense. Because I didn't think that was what the world was about. Right? First clue that I'm not very spiritual, right? And I thought I knew. It talks about a philosophy of life that comforts me. Right? A vision of what my life should be that I need to be comfortable. And I thought that if I just had the right education, I'd be able to get the right job and earn enough money to buy the right house and to get the right car. And all my stuff would attract her, the right her, and then I'd be okay. But I could never quite get the combination right. My discomfort would take me to the point where I would switch out cars, switch out girlfriends, and just trying to find the right combination to be okay. And if I wasn't okay, the problem was out here. I always focused on the problem out here. And it gives me a great exercise here that I look at in step one, and that's on page 52. Because it outlines some things that are really important to see how much I've focused on the things out here. As the things that I needed to be okay. But it asked me to do something different with them. It says we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. Right? It's asking me to look at my human problems in the same readiness to change my point of view as I did with alcohol. And so far we've looked at the alcohol and how it reacted inside. My physical craving and my mental obsessions that took me to the physical first drink. Didn't look at jails, didn't look at fights, didn't look at the fact that I lost my business or my marriage. It didn't say those were the things that make me alcoholic. Those were just a result of me being alcoholic. The thing that made me drink alcoholically was not even just my thinking, but specific thinking an obsession that takes me to a particular way of drinking. So in that sense, I've changed my point of view of what my problem was. I looked for my alcoholism inside rather than outside. Now it's saying, maybe we should do the same thing with our other human problems. It says we were having trouble with personal relationships. Right? Can you guys relate to that? That's especially when you just got here, having trouble with personal relationships. That I couldn't control my emotional nature. Right? And that doesn't mean that I keep my mouth shut. Right? That means the thing that goes on inside, even when I'm not vocalizing it. Then I pray to misery and depression. Am I vulnerable to misery and depression? It says we couldn't make a living. I couldn't create a life around me that was comfortable enough to keep me happy or sober. And I had a feeling of uselessness. Just before I got sober, I didn't see a lot of point in Dan being around here. Wasn't working, threw the wife out, was just basically surviving just to eat and drink. But full of fear. Right? My whole life was driven by fear. My actions were a result of fear of something. I was definitely unhappy. It says we were unhappy. And I couldn't be of real help to other people. And was not a basic solution for these bedevilments important to me. And it calls them bedevilments, things that haunt me. And some people would say, well, I drank over these things. Because this would outlay some feelings, right? Problems with personal relationships, can't control my emotions, fear, misery, and depression. It's easy for someone to say, well, see, I drank out because I felt bad. And you hear that a lot. People in meetings say, oh, this is a disease of feelings. I don't know if you've ever heard that. But when you look at it a little closer, yeah, I drank when she left. Okay. But I always drank when she came back, too. And yeah, I drank when I felt emotionally bad. You know, but feeling good was a good reason to drink too. You would think that if I felt good, my problem would get better. My alcoholic problem would get better if it was about feelings. But the truth is, I drank when the team won and I drank when the team lost. I drank when she left. I drank when she came back. I just drank. So there's something underneath these things that it wants me to see. Right? Is there any artists here in the room? All right. Define artist. All right. Is there any pictures in here? All right, the picture over there. If there's no artist in the room, you might not really be able to see this, but if you look at a picture of a lake, an artist rendition of a lake, and you look at the water is painted in the reflection of the things that are around the lake. You'll see the trees and the mountains and the sun and the lake. Right? That's how an artist paints something that's transparent. So see the condition of my spirit. The stuff here on page 52 becomes the palette which I paint, the picture of what my spiritual condition looks like. Because if I have problems in these areas, I have problems with this thing that's deep down inside that I can't see with my physical eyes, per se. But when I know what to look for, when I can look around at these things that I have problems with, and it gives me a picture of the spiritual condition that's deep down inside, that thing that previously was transparent to me. And the same holds true later on, is when, if this problem is removed, this will paint a picture of a different spiritual condition. Does that make sense? Okay. If you can relate to this, I know that when I was new, I used to go into meetings and read the promises on the wall, the 9-step promises that are the 12 promises that you see in most meetings. And even when I was new, I wanted to like think that I got this thing. Right? And I don't know if you were like this, where you read them, but yeah, I got that, yeah, I got that. Right? It's interesting that if you can relate to page 52, then you don't have the promises. Because page 52 is a test for the promises. And I was having some computer problems before I left. Otherwise, I would have printed more of these, but you're welcome to look at it. And you can also download it off my website at thejwalker.com. It's the bedevilments versus the promises. Because here's the bedevilments. And I matched them up. I actually cut them into little pieces of paper, and I matched them up. The first bedevilment is we were having trouble with personal relationships. And the promises say we will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. On page 52, it says we couldn't control our emotional natures. The promise on page 83 is we will comprehend the word serenity and will know peace. The bedevilments on page 52 say we were prey to misery and depression. The promise says our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. On 52, it says we couldn't make a living. On 83, it says fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. On 52, it says we had a feeling of uselessness. The promise says the feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. On page 52, it says we were full of fear. The promise on page 83 is, I will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle me. The bedevilment on page 52 says we were unhappy. The promise on 83 says we're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. Page 52, it says we couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. On 83, it says no matter how far down the scale we've gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. So, if I can relate to page 52, then I don't have the promises. But the good news is, you'll never find another book that in 31 pages will transform your life. And that's a big promise. So there's something else that becomes really important to stress here. Because in the beginning, they told me this was a spiritual problem. And I didn't understand what that meant. Or the importance of it. And what does that have to do with drinking? Right? Okay, I see that I have problems with all this stuff, with relationships, my emotions, misery and depression, all this stuff on page 52. I see that I drank, whether that was stuff was good or that was bad, and I can kind of get that what I'm supposed to see is there's something deep down inside, a condition that manifests these problems, my problems with this stuff in my life, my discontent, my unhappiness, even when things are good, right? Even when things are good, I could be discontent. It's just not enough. It's the wrong kind. But what I see here is that there's something to do with that in my drinking. It was obvious to me that the obsession took me to the first drink, but what I have to see now is that spiritual disorder sets up a condition conducive for the obsessions to return. tells me that later. Spiritual maladies overcome, I straighten up physically and mentally. Right? So if the spiritual malady is not overcome, the spiritual condition, which I can't see the actual spiritual malady, but I see the results of it, and I see that that sets up the condition conducive for the obsessions to return, that's important for me to know when I'm new. But you know what? It becomes really important for me to know when I've got some time in the program. Because with time, you've all known people to drink again with time. Right? So page 52 becomes a great test to paint a picture of the spiritual condition inside and to see where I'm at. Because if I blindly just ignore it, then and think that I'm not going to be one of those that drink again, right? Ask any of them. Plenty of them will tell you, I never thought that I would drink again. Right? I have to see the spiritual malady sets up a condition conducive for the obsessions to return. And when the obsession returns, it's not just thinking about drinking, it's an idea that outweighs any logic, and I'm going to drink. And when that obsession hits, there's an insanity that completely puts me in a situation that there's no calling anybody saying, hey, I'm in trouble. And I tell people that I work with, don't call me if you want to drink. Call me if you don't want to drink. But I also know that if the obsession hits, there's no calling anybody. No calling anybody. The other thing I have to see here is there's nothing that I can do about that condition on my own. I cannot relieve that spiritual deficiency on my own. If I go to a therapist, we could look at all the things that it points to. We could look at my relationships, and we could look at my emotions, and we could look at, and you know, and there's a lot of things, you know, I'm not putting down therapy. I think anything that gets me to some more truth is good. But I think ultimately I have to see that I can't do anything about that on my own. A therapist can't fix that part of me. The doctor can't fix that part of me. Even getting a better relationship can't fix that part of me, or a better job, or But I have this idea still that if I just set up the condition of my life around me, that I can change the condition inside. Right? There's a part of me that always refers, kind of defaults back to that. Fix the stuff around me to try to fix that part inside. Get rid of the relationship. It's not working. Get rid of it. You know, change jobs. Get more money. There's a great question that came up in our home group. It's like, how much money do you need before you don't need God? Right? Or how good does the relationship have to be before you don't need God? Yet, when a new person comes in, what's the first thing they start focusing on? You know, it's either pink or green. It's either pink or green. Money or relationships. It's funny because, you know, sometimes when you sponsor people, they get really impressed when you kind of like know ahead of time what they're thinking about. They call you up and they go, man, everything sucks. You know, and then you say, well, is it pink or green? And they say, what? What does that mean? And it's like, is it your money situation or your relationship? And it's so impressed that you hit it right on the nail. It's, yeah, those were what it is. That's what it is. You're a genius, right? Right? cannot straighten out the outsides enough to straighten out that spiritual condition on the inside. Not even not drinking straightens that out. Because the alcohol was what I used for many years as my medicine for that problem. But this spiritual malady, it's like this fracture in my spirit that causes this obsession for oblivion. And alcohol filled that space for many years. But near the end, I continued to get drunk. But once I started to have an experience with what alcohol was doing in my life, and it kind of messed up that part of me, part of it, that spiritual condition that it used to ease, because now the drinking was eating away at that, and just reinforcing the idea that there's something really wrong. And I have to see that spiritual condition, that spiritual malady was there before I even started to drink. And it was there after I stopped drinking. And I have to see that if long-term happy sobriety is in my future, I have to see what can touch that part of me, because that spiritual malady that I can't fix on my own. If I'm clear that I have that spiritual malady and it sets up a condition conducive for the obsessions to return and I'll drink again, that means the experience of step one is not that I can't drink again, but that I will, because I can't do anything about that spiritual malady on my own. If the subject of spiritual awakenings or spiritual experiences are a topic of a meeting, a lot of meetings you go to, they'll talk about nice, fuzzy, fluffy spiritual awakenings, like feel-good experiences. I've had some of those, but the trouble about feel-good experiences like that, I don't remember them. Right? The spiritual awakenings that I remember are the painful variety, the things that slap you in the face and wake you up to truths about your life. You know, who said a spiritual awakening is supposed to feel good? There was an awakening that comes from each step. And what you'll find is most of them don't necessarily feel good. Because I've woken up to the truth here in step one, is that even though I'm here, I could drink again. And there's nothing stopping me from drinking again. In the middle of an AA room, full of people that say they have a solution, all I've seen up to this point is that I have this problem that could take me back to the next drink. Right? And it moves me into this place, it moves me into the next step in a place of desperation. Right? Step one has to impact me enough to go along with the idea that I need a power greater than myself to restore me to sanity. So I have to see the insanity that this condition takes me to. And I have to be able to see that on my own, by myself, there's nothing I can do about that. So it's and just like what Bill talked about in the beginning when he shared the doctor's opinion with Dr. Bob, when he understood what the problem was, then he pursued God like his life depended on it. That's what step one has to do for me. It has to put me in a place where I know, without a shadow of a doubt, I better get more from this or I'm dead. So I'm going to stop there and we'll be back up here at what time? 10:30? You know, and we'll look at step two.